The enormity of Southern support for Nixon in the 1972 presidential election is still inadequately understood, mostly because its fruition between 1973 and 1976 was reversed by the Watergate scandal. I can remember being flabbergasted as I read the county-by-county figures weeks after the election. 2 decades later, in The Vital South, How Presidents Are Elected, political science professors Earl and Merle Black looked back on those dimensions as astonishing. The most overwhelming Southern white vote, 79%, ever won by a Republican presidential candidate. A peak that still stands. The University of Michigan's National Election Studies for 1972 put Nixon's share even higher at 82%. Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush never matched these levels. Nixon's shortfall was in not being able to enlarge the opportunity to include major congressional gains. Absent Watergate, some fusion of Southern Democrats and Republicans would almost surely have taken place. An unsullied Nixon would have claimed 62-63% of the presidential vote instead of 61%, avoided a stay-at-home moderate GOP protest movement, and pulled in 20-30 new Republican senators and congressmen instead of the net 10 seats actually gained. That increment, along with the omission of what by early 1973 became a blighting scandal, would have consummated high-level negotiations with 30-40 amenable Southern Democrats. As several accounts have rightly described, both the executive and legislative branches would have been reconfigured under some power-sharing arrangement. With Nixon destroyed, any hope of cross-party alliance fell apart, enabling the Democrats to narrowly win the 1976 presidential election. They did so with a born-again Southern Baptist ex-governor of Georgia, Jimmy Carter, who took 10 of the 11 ex-Confederate states, losing only Virginia. The role of the South in national politics was thrown back up into the air, or it appeared to be. On the day of Carter's inauguration in January 1977, Democrats controlled 9 of the 11 ex-Confederate governorships, 16 of the 22 Southern U.S. Senate seats, and almost three-quarters of the region's seats in the House of Representatives. The hemorrhage feared in 1972 had been avoided, and Carter's election pushed glum Republicans in Washington farther to the sidelines. The reduced percentage of Senate and House members from the South who were Republican in 1977 cut short the rise from just a handful in 1953 to not quite a quarter in 1969 and over 30% in 1973, postponing the sharp gains that early 1970s fusion would have brought until 1994. For a few years, Democrats dreamed of renewing their Southern and evangelical support, but in 1980, those hopes collapsed. Let me suggest an unacknowledged influence for the hiatus of the 1970s. Much of the short-lived post-1973 liberal renaissance produced by Watergate marshaled behind issues ultimately tied to religion. The Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision opening up the Pandora's box of legalized abortion, the secular campaign against school prayer, the excitement of women to put the Equal Rights Amendment into the Constitution, especially unpopular with religious conservatives committed to women's traditional role, and various aspects of the sexual revolution, gay rights, women's liberation, mainstream acceptance of pornography, and school or government distribution of contraceptives. All of these new issues surging to the fore angered conservative family values advocates. A 1972 fusion, by contrast, might well have reduced both the secular liberal pressure and the powerful counter-mobilization of the religious right. In retrospect, besides stalling electoral history, the delay ensured that the battle march would be onward Christian soldiers, not an occasional stanza of Dixie. As the new agenda led to culture wars, the Carter administration, despite its Southern accent, became an ambuscade for Democratic hopes below the Mason-Dixon line. Before further amplification, a central premise must be introduced. Among the vital, albeit unwilling, architects of the Republican Southern gains were the four Southern Democratic presidents of the second half of the 20th century. Three were Southern Baptists, Truman, Carter, and Clinton, and one belonged to the Disciples of Christ, Johnson. Over five decades, each pursued policies sought by National Democratic constituencies that strenuously contradicted traditional Southern stances on cultural, religious, foreign policy, and states' rights issues. Truman's desegregation of the military, his executive order prohibiting discrimination in federal employment, and other civil rights proposals spurred the 1948 revolt of the Dixiecrats, many of whom then took up GOP presidential voting in 1952. Johnson, in turn, alienated the core South with his advocacy of civil rights legislation and portions of the Great Society. Carter managed to annoy even his fellow Southern Baptists with his positions, and Clinton, despised in many of the region's churches, consummated the cultural and moral disenchantment. Racial policy, to some the obvious and all-encompassing explanation, in my opinion probably accounted for one-third to one-half of the white voter exodus that took place. Foreign policy, especially bungled war mismanagement, also offended the South, then and now America's most hawkish region. Truman and Johnson presided over the U.S. military embarrassments in Korea and then Vietnam. Carter often looked weak and in 1980 flubbed the rescue of the 53 Americans held hostage in Iran. Clinton's military image, in turn, took three wounds. From his youthful anti-Vietnam War stance, his impolitic emphasis during his first week in office on permitting gays to serve openly in the military, and the analogy posed by the Hollywood movie Wag the Dog, which caricatured a president who waged war in the Middle East to take Americans' eyes off a sexual liaison. Clinton profited on the economic front, but Truman, Johnson, and Carter all lost support by appearing to abet inflation, and the last of these suffered also from a re-election year recession. But if liberals tend to overstate race as the be-all and end-all, there is no doubt about its importance.